On March 30th, 1939, the world's foremost super sleuth emerged in Detective Comics number 27 and was so well received that within a year, he had a series of his own. From the outset in Batman number 1, a compilation of five short stories, visionaries let loose an egregious yin to the Caped Crusader's righteous yang with a murderous criminal who announces his intended misdeeds over the radio and unleashes a self-branded poison concocted out of household items. Joker Venom noxiously paralyzed its victims with irrepressible laughter and left a monstrous smirk on their faces. After a string of atrocities, Batman finally catches up to him, just in time for the Joker to fall from a great height, get captured, and thrown in the slammer, only to escape confinement two stories later in The Joker Returns, where the Gotham Guardian again tracks him down to witness the Joker stabbing himself in a climactic cliffhanger. But DC publishers knew they had something too choice on their hands to kill off the Joker and allowed his recurrence in 9 of the first 12 issues to irritate Batsy as only an archenemy could. This jester of genocide has undergone uncounted makeovers in the 84 years since, from genius to sadist to innocuous rogue, the latter of which was imputed by the Comics Code Authority of the 1950s, an institution that blames social aggression, homosexuality, and the criminal behavior of juveniles on comic book content. And I think it's fair to say that the code bears responsibility for altering the, what we would call today, graphic novel from gritty to goofy. Like the time the Joker abducted Robin and Batman's plan to entrap him was to write a ransom check and apprehend the crook while he cashed it at the bank. Or the Joker's undertaking to file a copyright infringement lawsuit against the smiling faces of laughing fish that resemble him. And who could forget episode 10 of the campy 1960s Batman television show, Surf's Up Joker Under, when the green-haired gag man kidnaps surfing champion Skip Parker to obtain his tubular dexterity using the Surfing Experience and Ability Transferometer to spellbind the citizens of Gotham by impelling the Dark Knight, sporting banana yellow swim trunks, over his superhero suit to look like a total Barney by besting him in a wave-riding competition. The facets of Joker's demeanor, temperament, and motivations have continued to fluctuate ever after. 1998's Batman Two Faces features Bruce Wayne developing a formula that endows him with unimaginable strength, with the caveat of a drastic Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde side effect splitting his personality between Batman and the Joker. And 2020's Batman Three Jokers explores the premise of not one, but a trio of individual Jokers that wreak havoc by their inherent terrorizing expertise: the prodigious criminal, the capering clown, and the depleted psychotic stooge. While there is some controversy around who exactly should be credited with the Clown Prince of Crime's conception, there is no argument that the steeplechase face logo of Coney Island was a huge inspiration, along with the Joker in a deck of cards. Called the Jolly in Italian decks, they came into existence in the 1860s specifically to be used as a trump card in the game of euchre. But it has since been multipurposed into other games as a wild card in Gin Rummy, a skip card in Crazy Eights, and the maid in Old Maid. There is no standard for how the Joker card is to be configured, and card companies go to great lengths creating unexampled concepts to distinguish their Jokers for what has become a lucrative collectibles industry. So, too, did artists intend to design Batman's nemesis as, quote, somebody visually exciting. Somebody that would make an indelible impression, would be bizarre, and would be memorable, like the Hunchback of Notre Dame or any other villains that had unique physical characteristics. End quote. Recognizable by his long-tailed purple suit, gloves, string tie, striped pants, and gaucho hat, he is, quote, bound only by his own rules without aspiring to something higher than himself. Unlike Batman, the slave, who makes a distinction between good and evil and is bound to rules outside of himself, such as his avoidance of killing, in his quest for justice. The Joker does not regret or assess the past and only moves forward. End quote. And if that doesn't make Batman look incompetent enough, the Joker has an arsenal of tools to rival those on the Dark Detective's utility belt. Deadly joy buzzers, exploding cigars, razor-tipped playing cards, and a lapel flower that squirts acid. The Harlequin of Hate even counters the Batplane and Batmobile with the Joker Gyro and the Joker Mobile. Super cool toys, by the way. Scattered curiosity, the Joker is one of only a few malefactors that can be found on kids' toys, like pajamas, socks, and board games. And in 1975, he became the first inked miscreant to front his own comic book series, The Joker. But it did not flourish like its foreboding predecessor because that pesky aforementioned comics code required that vagabonds be punished in every issue, amplifying the Joker's ineptitude by repeatedly getting dispatched to the notorious Arkham Asylum. As regulations loosened, the Joker got diplomatic immunity when appointed ambassador to Iran by the Ayatollah Khomeini. He pulverized the second Robin, Jason Todd, to death with a crowbar, paralyzed Barbara Gordon, aka Batgirl, and was subsidized with an entirely new origin story of a lab assistant turned failed joke maker who commits transgressions in the guise of the Red Hood to make ends meet and care for his pregnant wife. And then in 1992, DC explored the Ace of Knaves' toxic relationship with Harley Quinn, his obsessive Arkham psychiatrist, where, on separate occasions, he verbally berates her, physically harms her, and even threatens her life. Harley Quinn is obviously a play on the word harlequin, defined as, quote, a comic character in commedia dell'arte, usually masked, dressed in multicolored diamond-patterned tights and carrying a wooden sword or magic wand, end quote. And the terms harlequin, joker, jester, clown, comedian, and fool have been used interchangeably throughout time immemorial. These icons are so embedded into our culture that at one point or another, everybody plays the fool, at least according to the 1970s R&B group, The Main Ingredient. Come to think of it, foolery is incorporated into a lot of chart toppers. The Tears of a Clown by Smokey Robinson, Won't Get Fooled Again, The Who, Why Do Fools Fall in Love, Frankie Lyman, Fool on the Hill, The Beatles, Fool to Cry, The Rolling Stones, What a Fool Believes, The Doobie Brothers, Fools in the Rain, Led Zeppelin, Cool Fool, The Cars, Ship of Fools, Robert Plant, American Fool, John Cougar, Chain of Fools, Aretha Franklin, Kissing a Fool, George Michael, Fool in Love, Rihanna, New Fool at an Old Game, Reba McEntire, Nobody's Fool, Avril Lavigne and Miranda Lambert, Fool for the City, Foghat, Everybody's Somebody's Fool, Connie Francis, and Act a Fool, Ludacris. Indeed, fools have presided among the most consequential crossroads in world history. Surely you jest. No, and don't call me Shirley. I'm fooling with you. Entertainers have been inherent to the progress of civilization, as human beings crave leisurely stimulation, Have you ever taken a flight or a subway ride without a book, crossword puzzle, or headphones? Torture! Long ago, in the times before on-demand divertissement, bored people of influence could buy or receive slaves who were piquant or judicious or had a certain je ne sais quoi that always left them wanting more. Imperators proudly showed off the fastidious aptitude of their yoculator regis, king's fool, and when their funambulist made a poignant joke or ribbing remark, the patriarch would appropriate it as their own. Often, a japer would be chosen in concordance with the personality of the lord in question, from impious to pithy to poetic to insensitive to insane. It was with great regularity that a foudoua might come along on a conciliatory sortie and be seated nearer their benefactors than the men of the cloth. These were licensed scoundrels, with permission to deride autocrats in a way that would find most people beheaded. Because when gerents reached their paramount, they desired a crony that would make known things they needed to hear, not what they wanted to hear. And these consorts were dragooned to tell it like it is. Quote, withal, there was laughter excited by the liberty of speech, which must have occasionally fallen like refreshing dew upon the ear of a despot or noble, unaccustomed to listen to aught from others save his own exceeding glorification. End quote. The voracious henchmen even engaged in espionage. So no mistake was made about who was a sanctioned pantaloon, the wags were bedecked with a chaplet, referred to as the cap and bells, and a marat, a stick or bat with a tiny fool's head at the top, to bizarrely parallel the coronet and scepter of royalty. Substitutes for the marat would come in the form of painted wood sabers or play daggers. Such accessories, and the versicolored motley pattern diamond jerkin uniform, like those from the Joker cards, were prevalent from the Middle Ages through the English Restoration. However, wearing such regimentals was not compulsory in every kingdom, and oftentimes, comic cut-ups were dressed according to current trends. Some were full-time live-in funny men, while others were free to tour with theatrical troupes and return to court for big events. Such was the case for Roland Le Poutour, a.k.a. Roland the Farter, a 12th century flatulist whose signature Christmas routine was unum saltum et syphilatum et unum bumbleum, one jump and whistle and one fart. Poutour's display of ass mastery earned him widespread acclaim and a Suffolk manor on 30 acres of land from King Henry II of England, which Roland was authorized to hand down to his children. Farts have always been gelastic. Just ask St. Augustine, who is mesmerized by those that, quote, produce at will such musical sounds from their behind without any stink, that they seem to be singing from that region, end quote. Specialists like Roland were, in many cases, paid better than the clergy, who despised how close wingdings got to majesties and disparaged them. Not so much for their faculty, but the lavish rewards that exceeded the dispensation provided, such as robes of gray squirrel skin and ermine, of rabbit skins and violet stuffs, horses, and money. Things that holy men affirmed should be given to the destitute or the church. Quote, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. End quote. Unlike most occupations of yesteryear, trifling was not relegated to men only. Perhaps the most famous plaisant, what they called French lady jesters, was Mathurine de Valois, who fooled to King Henry II, Henry IV, and Louis XIII. To get a feel for Mathurine's bandiage, one time at court, a woman of high stature commented that she did not like having a fool at her right side. So, Mathurine flanked the mademoiselle's left side and proclaimed, quote, "I don't mind it at all," end quote. Fantastic. Mathurine played the recurring character of an Amazonian, arrayed with a wooden scimitar and shield. But the reason history remembers her has to do with an assassination attempt on Henry IV's life as he slept. The nearby Mathurine heard the kerfuffle and rushed to hold the door shut so the would-be murderer could not escape. Mathurine was suspected of complicity in the coven and briefly caged before being exonerated of any wrongdoing and returning to fool at court. Disclaimer: this episode will contain objectionable nomenclature. There is no way around it. Language and customs of yore seem harsh to modern sensibilities. But we at Scattered Curiosities believe our audience knows the mission is to inform, not offend, and that we do not censor sources. That said, dwarves, or persons of diminutive stature, as they preferred to be called, were common companions for rulers as far back as 2284 BC. When the pharaoh Neferker, Pepi II's pygmy fool, was ordered to mesmerize the sun god with his Swaziest dance moves. In ancient Ireland, dwarfs were regarded as enchanted intellects from another world, and Roman women of stature loved dwarves. They were all the rage. You had to have one. French archives chronicle the feats of Madame d'Or, a, quote, "gymnast of incomparable beauty, nimbleness, and athletic vigor," end quote, who is said to be a, quote, "dwarf no higher than a boot," end quote. This very graceful fool made a splash at the induction of the Order of the Golden Fleece, celebrating the Duke of Burgundy's connubiality to Isabella of Portugal with her esoteric charms. Scattered curiosity, there is an Australian wine, circa 2013, that is named Madame d'Or. A la vôtre! The lexeme fool, from the Latin folus, meaning bag of wind, is a broad locution with subcategories that I will outline now. Houses of the highborn would frequently keep natural fools and counterfeit fools. A natural was a person with a learning or developmental disability, or someone that was so childishly unpretentious that their comments and behavior defied the logic and mode of mannerly norms. These naturals were also called innocents. In medieval times, a natural fool would be pigeonholed as mentally defective or with, quote, "deficiency in their education, experience, or innate capacity for understanding," end quote. And such indwellers were jeered by the Commonwealth and spasmodically disowned by their parents, left to find refuge in compassionate houses of prayer. And while the notion that these innocents were retained for the amusement they provided to the monotony of a ruler's day may seem cruel, the truth of the matter is, hordes of these individuals might not have survived the times otherwise. It was considered utterly benevolent to take them in, nourish them, clothe them, and expose them to a world that your average peasant could only imagine. Naturals would also be given untroublesome duties in the privy chamber to keep them busy, like watering flowers or feeding hens. Because they often knew no better, an innocent was rarely in mortal danger if they spoke their mind inappropriately or out of turn to their sovereign, because the kibitzer, quote, "lives in a profession he does not understand," end quote. These incorruptible Maryandrews were thought to be rarefied, touched by God, and sent to test the divinity and mercy of state heads. Conversely, The counterfeit, or clever, fools knew exactly what was going on and had to tread cautiously with a privileged tongue. Artificial fools were paid soubrettes expected to liven the mood of any venue, at home or overseas. These versificators excelled in a tapestry of talents, such as singing, tumbling, impersonations, juggling, magic tricks, roast-style lambasting, and telling topical jokes pertaining to catered gossip in a specific locality. Some would travel back and forth across the English Channel and were exalted around Europe. Larkers were valuable assets to armies on the march by ridiculing and dehumanizing the enemy to raise morale, and to field commanders by sarcastically shedding light on incautious tactics. The Celtic Riadruth, King's Fool, were expected to fight battles and provide blithesome rollicking. Same goes for the Norman Joculatoris, one of whom, named Taillefer, decapitated an opponent at the Battle of Hastings. Now that's funny. An anecdote from the early 200s BC recalls the second Chinese Emperor Shen wanting to lacquer the Great Wall, much to the dismay of his advisors, who thought the arduous and expensive task to be a waste of resources and lives, but dared not castigate the emperor. It took the over-the-top, acerbic agreement of Shen's fool, Twisty Pole, to deflate that thought bubble by bleating, quote, "That's a splendid idea. Lacquer the Great Wall all smooth and shiny, then it will be too slippery for any invaders to climb over it. Now let's get down to the practical side of the job. The lacquering is easy enough, but building a drying room may present a problem or two," end quote. When Shen heard it spelled out that way, the wall was left unlacquered, and everyone sighed a breath of relief. Attila the Hun brought satirists on campaign, who would, quote, "successively excite the mirth of the rude spectators by their deformed figure, absurd speeches, and the strange, unintelligible confusion of the Latin, the Gothic, and the Hunnic languages. And the hall resounded with lewd and licentious peals of laughter. In the midst of this intemperate riot, Attila alone, without a change of countenance, maintained his stern and inflexible gravity," end quote. Suggesting Attila did not care for having his funny bone tickled, but recognized that the masses did. Veritably, a potentate was not always pleased with his vassals. Constantine IX's Byzantine fool, Romanus Boilus, was machinating regicide to usurp the throne and Constantine's mistress, and Philip VI of France took little solace from sardonic condolences supervenient of a naval defeat when his fool proclaimed, quote, "Those cowardly Englishmen, those chicken-hearted Britons had not the courage enough to jump into the sea like your own sailors, who went headlong from their ships, leaving them to the enemy who did not dare follow them," end quote. The morpheme jester, an amalgamation of the Anglo-Norman gesteur, did not come into vogue until the Tudor era of England, a 118-year time span materializing from the Battle of Bosworth, when the derelict leader of the Lancaster faction of the War of Roses, Henry Tudor, was dubbed king by virtue of conquest after killing King Richard III and pilfering his crown. To solidify the rulership and quell the civil war, Henry VII married the niece of his extinguished traducer, Elizabeth of York. By his side was a clever fool that also toured part-time named John Scott, whose first lofty appearance was a New Year's Day celebration, a date he played annually along with Easter, until retiring from the court to go full pro. Which was fine, because the first order of business for Henry was to sire a male heir, which he did with the birth of Arthur, a second son, also named Henry, 5 years later, and a third boy, Edmund, 8 years after that. Henry and Elizabeth also had 4 daughters, 2 of which would be queens abroad. Margaret married James IV of Scotland, and Mary wed Louis XII of France. At age 14, Arthur Tudor entered an arranged marriage with Catherine of Aragon, a coupling that had been in place since the Prince of Wales was 3 years old. Sadly, Arthur died from sweating sickness 6 months after the consortium, leaving his ignominious brother at the head of the line. It is at this juncture that I want to take a little detour from our main topic and give an abbreviated monology of this dynasty whose melodramatic saga rivals those from Game of Thrones, because the characters involved enacted policies that carried medieval Britons into and through the Age of Discovery. For this reason, there are tons more verifiable facts about the goings-on at court that includes their innocent and counterfeit fools. Hopefully, this won't get too confusing, as every other person in this story is either named Henry, Mary, Philip, Catherine, Elizabeth, Edward, Anne, Louis, or Jane. Now, Henry VIII married his dead older brother's widow, Catherine of Aragon, took the throne at age 18, and inherited a financial surplus from his fiscally conservative father. This specimen of a man that splurged on lavish clothing, was inclined to change outfits several times a day, and nicknamed the King of 1,000 Slippers, took faddism a step further with his statutes of apparel. Sumptuary laws that dictated what people could and could not wear. For example, only royals could wear purple, and you had to be a duke to wear gold. A capable lute player himself, Henry brought music and the arts into his arena and advocated minstrel groups. It should be noted that the word minstrel applied to poets, philosophers, and all-around revelers, not just musicians. As Henry cozied up to his eminent brother-in-law, Louis XII of France, he contrarily signed a pact with Ferdinand II to join the Pope's anti-French Holy League. Henry then assailed the land of wine and cheese, and while gone, his other brother-in-law, James IV of Scotland, swarmed over England and met his maker at the hands of combatants supervised by Queen Catherine. Louis died soon after, and his cousin Francis I took control. After 6 miscarriages in 15 years, Catherine and Henry finally had a child, Princess Mary, who would be promised to both Francis I's son and her cousin Charles V to secure alliances, but both engagements were dissolved. Though not the son that he coveted, Henry doted upon Princess Mary and entrusted unto her an innocent known as Jane Our Fool. Evidently, the Tudors were quite charmed by Jane, because records show that more gowns and accessories made of exquisite materials were parceled out to Jane than anyone else in the kingdom except the Queen. Jane even participated in the Valentine's Day lottery, where the men would draw names for dance partners, and those that showed Jane an enjoyable time were amply rewarded. Overseeing the child actors that performed for Mary was the king's jester, John Heywood, who was, quote, beloved and rewarded by Henry VIII for his buffooneries, end quote. John was a remarkable singer, wrote songs for Mary, and was a celebrated epigrammist. However, his plays have been chided as, quote, altogether void of plot, humor, and character, end quote. While there is no doubt Henry venerated his only child, who read and wrote in Latin, French, and Spanish, despite being a girl, he did have a son with one of Catherine's ladies-in-waiting, a bastard boy named Fitzroy, but illegitimate children had no rights of law. Henry had taken innumerable mistresses, his prerogative as king, mind you, including his seven-year courtship of Anne Boleyn after having sampled both her sister, another of Catherine's ladies-in-waiting, Mary Boleyn, and their mother. Ironic that his motto was Cœur Loyal, true heart. But Anne would not go all the way while Henry was still married, presenting him with the king's great matter of succession. He could either legitimize Fitzroy, have Princess Mary hitched off and birth a grandson, or get the legal partnership with Catherine erased and tie the knot with Anne to furnish supplementary bona fide offspring. In 1527, Henry asseverated the 24-year sacrament with Catherine to be in violation of Leviticus 20:21, which states, quote, if a man takes his brother's wife, it is severe defilement, and he has disgraced his brother. They shall be childless, end quote. This was proof enough for Henry that their coadunation was, quote, blighted in the eyes of God, end quote, and explained why they had not been blessed with a son. Henry then asked Pope Clement VII to rescind the concatenation, but did not get his way. A predictable outcome, as Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, was Catherine's nephew. Henry blamed the causatum on his Lord High Chancellor of 14 years and Mary's godfather, Cardinal Wolsey. Having fallen out of favor politically and sensing his days were numbered, Wolsey gifted his loyal fool, a limp-legged innocent of enormous physical stature who went by the honorific Patch, to Henry. Patch furiously rampaged when he was handed over, and it took 6 nights to drag him to court, where he was outfitted with the finest garb, a wig, oodles of nightcaps, and attended by 3 caretakers who rotated shifts. One allegory starring the simpleton involves Henry granting Patch the authority to collect an egg from every husband in the region who was discontented with their wife's predilections. Patch then turned to Henry and contemned, quote, your grace belongs to the class of husbands on whom I am entitled to make levy, end quote. Hilarious. The precept was revoked. And against the best interests of his domain, Henry decided to take the plunge with Anne Boleyn in secret and ousted Queen Catherine, demoting her to Princess Dowager and the Princess Mary to Lady Mary. Within a year, the Queen Consort gave birth to Princess Elizabeth. Henry signed the Act of Succession that disinherited Mary, and Cardinal Wolsey, because he either could not or would not secure secular blessing for Henry's violation of religion, was charged with treason and left to breathe his last in confinement. Mary, understandably, did not acknowledge Anne Boleyn or her new half-sister Elizabeth as resplendent, which further strained the relationship with her father. Patch, too, was forsaken from high society when Sir Nicholas Carew, the master of the horse, provoked the hulking innocent to adduce Anne Boleyn as a ribald and Princess Elizabeth as a bastard. Sir Nick was cast to the block. Patch's fate is unknown, but his epithet became synonymous with the motley or patched robes that he wore. Henry's feud with Rome intensified when he dared to have the Bible translated into English so anyone could read it and have the scripture manipulated to suit his entirely new offshoot of Christianity, the Church of England. This was wildly popular amongst the common folk who no longer needed a priest to interpret the Latin written tome to them. This circumvention of the Pope's prestige got Henry excommunicated, marking the beginning of the English Reformation. Overnight, Catholicism became illegal with the signing of Henry's Acts of Supremacy, which made him the transcendent head of the Church of England. Convents and monasteries were cited for buggery and ransacked by baronial dictum, displacing their reverend curators and the poor wretches they sheltered. Henry further importuned that the theater troops he sponsored promote the rules of the new religion, discount the Pope's authority, and praise his. This made for icy relationships with Catholic Spain and France, forcing Henry to fund the Royal Navy to protect his island nation. And a number of defiant subjects defected to these countries to escape religious persecution. With all this, Henry was still dissatisfied. Anne was not an agreeable pushover, and he abhorred her well-educated petulance almost as much as her not producing a male heir. He was further provoked to acrimony when Anne publicly chastised Henry's ongoing affairs. After burning a throng of bridges to get his way and upending a whole country's catechism for Protestant dogma, Henry went into PR mode to endear his people to him by hosting a jousting tournament, in which he competed and got knocked off his horse, rendering him unconscious for 2 hours. Henry seemed a different man when he awoke and suffered a miasmic debilitating leg injury that spurred an even shorter temper than before. Anne, who was pregnant at the time with what they later learned was a boy, miscarried. Henry saw that as a betrayal and had the departed Cardinal Wolsey's protege and Henry's principal secretary, Thomas Cromwell, gather dirt on Anne from her maidens, to whom she was overtly cruel. They accused the queen of cheating on Henry with multiple suitors, including her own brother. The confederation was voided, and Henry had her head for desecrating the crown, making Anne Boleyn the only woman in English history to get beheaded with a sword instead of an axe. A huge honor. Henry got engaged to his new mistress, Jane Seymour, the day after Anne was killed, and the pair was joined in holy matrimony 10 days after that. In the wake of the solemnity, Henry asked Lady Mary to officially recognize him as the head of the Church of England and deny the Pope. She did so under duress. Forever after the jousting accident, Henry needed a good laugh because his affliction prevented him from the activities he loved, and his appetite for total control was only matched by his actual hunger. He grew considerably in girth over the years, proven by the progressively expanding shape of his armor. Fatty foods and poor digestion made important another position at court that was more intimate with the king than his fool, the groom of the stool, a highly sought-after position of attending to Henry before, during, and after he visited his chamber pot. One BM on record beseeched the groom of the stool to perform an hours-long enema until Henry experienced a, quote, fair siege, end quote. Because of his commiseration with Catholicism, John Heywood self-extirpated. and the void of his absence was filled with the, quote, best of Tudor court fools of the innocent kind, end quote, Will Summers, said to be the only person other than John who could make the lachrymose Lady Mary laugh. Cherished by the family as he was, Will got jealous when other jesters made the king winsome. During one exploit, Will denigrated Thomas Brandon, a for-hire juggler, mid-performance by entering the hall with a roll of bread and a glass of milk, hearkening the king to hand him a spoon. Thomas angrily interjected that Will use his hands, to which Summers melodically responded, quote, "This bit, Henry, I give to thee, and this next bit I must serve for me, both of which I'll eat apace. This bit, madam, unto you, and this bit I eat myself now, and the rest upon thy face," end quote. At which point Will splashed his milk in the thick of Brandon's bearded visage, driving Thomas to draw his knife and lunge at Will, halted only by an enraged Henry. Thomas Brandon never juggled there again. Not above a good pun, which were cutting-edge humor at the time, Will would impute the king's auditors as frauditors and receivers as deceivers. Priceless. You don't even need to imagine what Will looked like because he shows up in more than one portrait of Henry and was included in a family vignette wherein he is depicted with a pet monkey grooming his head. Stout and disjointed in the neck and shoulder area, Summers performed mock combat with pasteboard armor, foils, and crowns at Christmas, and intermittently took the stage in matching outfits with Jane Foole, who also looms in that monkey painting. A year after uniting with Jane Seymour, Henry finally got his heart's desire, a living son, Edward. But complications from the birth took the mother's life a week later. Proximate to Jane's death, Lady Mary was named her baby brother's godmother, just before Henry signed the Second Succession Act, which made Edward next in line and disallowed both Mary and Elizabeth. Henry wasted no time looking for another wife to secure a spare heir and was presented with the lovely simulacrum of Anne of Cleves. Henry agreed to marry her at once based on this profile pic without ever having met Anne in person and felt duped when laying eyes on her in the flesh. Quote, "I promise you, I see no such thing as hath been shown me of her by pictures and report. I am ashamed that men have praised her as they have done, and I love her not." End quote. Marriage annulled. Next up was the buxom Catherine Howard, who was found to be unfaithful to Henry throughout their 2-year merger and met the same fate as her first cousin, Anne Boleyn. Henry's final agglutination was to Catherine Parr, who convinced him to bury the hatchet with his daughters and forge the Third Succession Act, putting Mary and Elizabeth back in line behind Edward. Henry VIII died on January 28, 1547, at age 55. The kingdom was now in the hands of 9-year-old Edward VI, who held the crest for 5 years with the assistance of a council, in which time he signed his own act of succession, taking Mary and Elizabeth out of the running again, and putting his father's grandniece, Lady Jane Grey, in queue to ensure the survival of the Church of England. Unfortunately, at age 15, Edward contracted measles, which set off a chain reaction in his immune system that developed into a ruinous lung infection. Consequent to her brother and godson's untimely demise, Lady Mary, supported by a Catholic army, snatched the throne from Lady Jane Grey and instantly reversed the English Reformation, restoring houses of worship to Catholic doctrine. Apart from Lady Jane's brief 9-day appointment, Mary was the first queen regnant of England, and her devout friend John Heywood returned for the coronation, where there were already grumblings over England's Jure Auxiliaris, which stated, quote, "The property and titles belonging to a woman become her husband's upon marriage," end quote, which freaked people out when she entered a political union with Philip II of Spain. The idea of having a foreign Catholic king set in motion contrivances to have Mary whacked. Elizabeth was implicated in one such conspiracy, interrogated, and held in the Tower of London for good measure. Mary thought Philip very handsome when presented with his portrait, but, like Henry VIII in the Anne of Cleves catfishing fiasco, Philip did not reciprocate Mary's affections when meeting face to face. She was nearly 40 when they wed. Plus, provisions were put in place stipulating that Philip would not obtain the diadem of England should Mary die. Phil was displeased with this arrangement and returned to Spain, visiting only to take stabs at procreation. Eventually, Mary began showing signs of pregnancy, and Elizabeth was released from prison to witness the birth of her half-niece or nephew. But no baby came. Mary disclosed it was, quote, "God's punishment for tolerating heretics in the realm," end quote. So, the queen doubled down on her crusading and got ruthless by demonizing all Protestants, and went so far as to compel one archbishop to bear witness to his colleagues burned at the stake, forswear his faith, and rejoin the Catholic Church. Then, instead of accepting his repent, burned him at the stake, at which time he apostatized his recanting. 283 people were singed in this way, bequeathing them as martyrs, and the queen with the diminutive Bloody Mary. When she claimed to be pregnant a second time, people at court joked it would, quote, "end in wind rather than anything else," end quote. There's that fart humor again. These phantom pregnancies, a medical condition that occurs when a woman desires to have a baby and misinterprets a distended abdomen or changes in her endocrine system, were most likely a cancerous tumor. After 6 years at the wheel, Mary died with both Elizabeth and John Heywood at her side. Quote, "She was a king's daughter. She was a king's sister. She was a king's wife. She was a queen, and by the same title, a king also," end quote. After the funeral, Heywood packed his bags and spent his final days, quote, "in laughter, jokes, jibes, and fearful jesting with the king of death, who was summoning him to his court." At age 25, Elizabeth I was inaugurated in Westminster Abbey, an event that marked Will Somers's last time at court. Heading what is hailed as England's Golden Age, Elizabeth reinstituted her father's religious policies and enforced mandatory attendance to the Church of England. Again, people worried about the alien encroachment of the Catholic threat and whether a woman could protect them. But Elizabeth was good at the job. So good that some insinuated that she was a man in disguise because she never married or birthed an heir. Who could blame her? Kings were dangerous. Just look at what her father did to her mother and stepmother. Not to mention, giving birth back then was equally fatal, as evidenced by yet another stepmother. Elizabeth was concerned that France would attack England and put her Catholic cousin Mary, Queen of Scots, in power, and sent a delegation to inculcate a Protestant stronghold there. Mary fled Scotland and hoped Elizabeth would grant her asylum, which came in the form of being housed in the Tower of London for 19 years. Aims were made to free Mary and put her on the throne, but none of the operations were successful, and over 750 of the cabal were executed. Socially, Elizabeth stunned people with her extravagantly fashion-forward wardrobe, especially her trademark pearls that would be embedded into the crown of Elizabeth II 4 centuries later. Liz cycled through umpteen fools during her 44-year reign, starting with a dancer named Jack Green, who set trends with his plume of 14 feathers, outdone only by Elizabeth's hat adorned with 16 feathers and golden spangles. Then there was the bitter fool, John Pace, who was an intellect of both Eton and King's College, Cambridge, before becoming a jester to the Duke of Norfolk. John Heywood commented of him, quote, "It is better for the Commonwealth for wise men to go in fools' coats than for fools to go in wise men's gowns," end quote. Once consigned to Elizabeth, she wheedled, quote, "Come on, Pace, now we shall hear of our faults," end quote. To which he replied, quote, "I do not use to talk of that all the town talks of," end quote. That was the end of that relationship, and the follow-up fool, Fulshorst, insulted her Secretary of State and got thrown into the clink for the slight. It took a lot of trial and error before Elizabeth's favorite comedian, Richard Tarleton, came onto her payroll. With the moniker Gentleman of the Chamber, Richard toured professionally as a member of the Queen's Players, but did wear the cap and bells while he was in the castle. Tarleton could do it all. Sing, write, manage a blade, dance a mean jig, impersonate a drunk, and excelled in physical comedy. Once, he affixed a strip of bacon to his back and feigned terror as Elizabeth's lapdog chased him around. Quote, "When Queen Elizabeth was serious, I dare not say sullen and out of good humor, he could undumpish her at his pleasure. He told the queen more of her faults than most of her chaplains and cured her melancholy better than all her physicians," end quote. Elizabeth's last fool of note was John Garrett, who jousted on a tiny horse about the size of a mastiff that, quote, "made her majesty very merry," end quote. Continued schemes to liberate the still subjugated Mary further confirmed her existence as a threat, forcing Elizabeth to have her chopped. Meanwhile, Elizabeth's fortunes contributed to her own demise. For instance, sugar, a once rare commodity, had become abundant during her ascendancy. And the queen was such a junkie that she dressed her salads with the sweet grainy delight. As a result, her teeth blackened, decayed, and fell out. It did not help that she feared dentists and brushed her teeth with honey. Advancing in age, balding with bad breath, Liz desperately tried to cling to her youth by caking on makeup comprised of vinegar and white lead powder that actually worsened her smallpox-damaged skin. Walter Raleigh, who claimed the Virginia Territory of the Americas for Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen, called her a, quote, "lady whom time had surprised," end quote. Having never named an heir before she died in 1603, Elizabeth was succeeded by the, quote, wisest fool in Christendom, end quote, her first cousin twice removed, James VI of Scotland. Elizabeth co-occupies a sepulcher with her half-sister Mary that reads, quote, consorts in realm and tomb, here we sleep, Elizabeth and Mary, sisters in hope of resurrection, end quote. While it is chronologically accurate that the upsurge of William Shakespeare coincided with Elizabethan rule, she was little associated with his rise to fame, more of a tolerant of the arts than a patron. The Bard of Avon was predisposed to use his player fools, costumed in eared hoods and coxcombs, who were esteemed by the Globe Theatre groundlings, lower-class audience members that could not pay for seats and thusly watched from the ground level. An actor who played scads of these parts was our old pal, Richard Tarleton, who sadly died of the plague and is buried alongside Will Somers. A contemporary of Tarleton, who played similar roles, was a thespian by the name of Robert Armin. Armin's stage fools were of the palatial type, more cerebral, less bumbling, and consistently breaking the fourth wall to psychoanalyze and talk, sometimes seriously, to the crowd about romance, betrayal, and patricide. But Billy Shakes also knew you gotta make with the ha-has, even in tragedies, and alternated farcical and macabre scenes, such as the comedic Gravediggers in Hamlet, posterior to Ophelia's suicide. And who could forget poor Yorick, a fellow of infinite jest, referred to prior to Hamlet's big skull-clutching speech. You know the one I mean. A short list of Shakespearean fools, and I'm leaving out a lot, are the two Dromios in the Comedy of Errors, Dogberry in Much Ado About Nothing, Grumio in Taming of the Shrew, Falstaff in Henry IV Parts 1 and 2, Speed in Two Gentlemen of Verona, Nick Bottom and Puck from A Midsummer Night's Dream, Trinculo in The Tempest, and the Fool in King Lear, who is of the innocent variety and the only character that can openly question the absurd actions of the king. Scatter curiosity, Fool is a novel by Christopher Moore told from the perspective of Pocket, the fool from King Lear. In it, Pocket endeavors to thwart King Lear from betrothing his daughter Cordelia to the Prince of France, but fails and seeks counsel from the ghost of Cordelia's dead mother, who bolsters Pocket to ignite discord between Lear's other two daughters, Regan and Goneril. Ultimately, Lear and Pocket wind up in a dungeon when Cordelia returns years later at the head of a French army. After a bit of suicide and some murder by throwing knives, Pocket discovers he is the nephew of the now deceased King Lear and marries Cordelia. Fool even has two sequels. The Serpent of Venice, also told by Pocket, which puts Othello and the Merchant of Venice into a blender with Edgar Allan Poe's The Cask of Amontillado, and Shakespeare for Squirrels, which throws Pocket into A Midsummer Night's Dream. The end of Tudor tenure in England was the beginning for the Stuart bloodline, starting with James VI, for whom the King James Bible is named, which was an updated version of the holy book Henry VIII released 72 years earlier with revisions and amendments to suit the current kingship. James assigned a Scottish sheep thief, prone to obscene ruses, as his fool. Archibald Armstrong, also known as Salt Archie, excoriated bishops, was skeptical of foreigners, and was a brazen mouthpiece for public opinion. But Court Archie let things go to his head and grew to be despised by much of the Presidium during his 12 years of ministration, in which time he had been given a bounteous salary, luxurious clothing, and a monopoly on the sale of his patented tobacco pipes. After recurrent antics like instigating fights between James and his eldest son over their popularity, Archie the Dizzard was dribbled out of court in 1618. 5 years later, he found himself in Spain with Lord Buckingham and Prince Charles to participate in nuptial negotiations and was well received by the Spanish, according to him. Not bloody likely, though, because while there, he prattled on about the defeat of the Spanish Armada while simultaneously fustigating Lord Buckingham's conduct of the operation. Buckingham threatened to have Archibald hanged, spurring Armstrong's retort, quote, "Dukes had often been hanged for insolence, but never fools for talking," end quote. This must have made an impression on Prince Charles, because when he was upgraded to King Charles I, Archie was back on the payroll, reproaching the greatest enemy of three kings, Lord Buckingham. However, when his matchless rival died, Archie restationed his biting remarks to the 5-foot-tall Archbishop of the King of England and Doctor of Divinity, William Laud, once bellowing to the court, quote, "Great praise be given to God, and little laud to the devil," end quote. Laud insisted that Armstrong, quote, "have his coat pulled over his head and be discharged the king's service and banished from the king's court," end quote. And Laud's wish was granted. But the king's pleasant still collected royalties from his tobacco pipes. Having jested himself into a fair estate, Archibald settled in London as a moneylender, and though reported to the House of Lords for his rife dubious contraventions, it was William Laud that would be tried for treason and decollated. Archie lived into his late 60s, appropriately dying on April 1st, All Fool's Day. The foul taste that Armstrong left in the mouths of elites was relieved by Charles's extraordinary palate-cleansing court dwarf, Geoffrey Hudson, a.k.a. Lord Minimus, an 18-inch pituitary dwarf preeminently regarded for his proportional littleness. So anomalous was Hudson's stature that a portrait of Geoffrey the Dwarf in Wood or Wilderness was commissioned in his lifetime. Described as a rarity of nature, Geoffrey became a known entity to King Charles I and Queen Henrietta Maria while attending a feast hosted by the Duchess of Buckingham when the tiny cynosure jumped out of a giant pie regaled in a child-sized suit of armor. This shtick was broadened into a two-man routine with William Evans, a physical giant, who would pull Geoffrey and a loaf of bread out of his pocket and pretend to make a sandwich out of him. Geoffrey was a marvelous dancer and exceeded physical comedy with his witty banter. In time, he made it clear that he no longer desiderated to be a novelty and was detached from his birth after challenging a French noble to a duel, which was illegal at the time. The situation worsened when Jeff's opponent armed himself with what could be described as a water gun, while Hudson brought a real gun and shot the man in the forehead. France wanted Geoffrey to face corporal punishment, but Henrietta Maria negotiated for exile. On the way out of town, Hudson found himself the hostage of Barbary pirates before his return to jolly old England 25 years later and 45 inches taller, a miracle ascribed to the, quote, "hardships he had suffered in captivity," end quote. Days of the English court jester concluded with the staunch Puritan Charles II, Syriac to the Restoration period, when fools had been edged out of stage plays, sometimes by legal decree. A 1681 staging of King Lear removed the fool entirely, and he would not resurface until 1828. But funny folk continued to be employed by Spanish, Russian, and German royals until the 18th century and were phased out in France with the eradication of the monarchy. But lest you think that court jesters have gone the way of the dodo, in 1999, the nation of Tonga appointed a man named Jesse Bogdanov as the court jester to the king, after having been a financial advisor to the nation for 5 years. In what must have seemed like the second coming of Archibald Armstrong, Jesse was embroiled in a pecuniary scandal for laxity without being charged with fraud. And Nigel Roeder, a.k.a. Kester the Jester, was lauded as the established state jester of England in 2004. But got pushback from Jonathan the Jester, a spokesperson for the Guild of Jesters, for using the phrase state jester. Parliament intervened and changed Roeder's decoration to English Heritage Jester. But before you quit your job to join the Royal Order of Jesters, a pre-World War I organization founded in Aloha Temple, Hawaii, keep in mind the consortium only admits Shriners by invitation. Their worldwide courts enroll no more than 13 new associates per year, and if you ask to enlist, you are not getting in. But nothing can stop you from visiting their museum in Indianapolis dressed as your favorite version of the Joker. Not even Batman.
To help us keep the curiosities coming, please rate us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to visit scatteredcuriosities.com for exclusive free downloads and to donate to the show.